Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
How many of you are familiar with Flannery O'Connor? Oh, good. How many of you have read at least one short story of Flannery O'Connor's? Okay, what about at least five stories? Anyone read a novel? Okay, good. You've read a lot, so that's good. All right, well, it sounds like most people are familiar with her. As James said, I'm a political scientist, so I'm not by training somebody who studies literature, although I went to a PhD program, both an undergraduate program and then a PhD program where literature was taken quite seriously. So I did read literature as part of my studies at Baylor, but not O'Connor. We read a lot of Shakespeare and other things. I wrote my dissertation on John Rawls. How many of you have read John Rawls? Okay, fewer of you. That's good. John Rawls, it kind of was an accident in a way that I found myself in a position where I had something to say about John Rawls in American politics, and so that became my dissertation. I thought it would be a good thing to do when I was on the job market, and it worked, I guess. But spending 3 years with John Rawls and then turning it into a book afterwards, which took another 3 years or so, I read a lot of Rawls, and I needed something to save me from the arid dryness of that abstract political philosophy. And I needed something concrete, and so I turned to literature, and I just happened to turn to O'Connor. She kept popping up in different ways in my life as though it was an invitation to get to know her better. So I just started reading O'Connor's stories for fun, and then I wrote a couple of conference papers, again, just to dive into something very concrete. Literature is very concrete, and I needed that, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And then I just kept thinking about her. I still think about her. And the students at St. Vincent often ask for reading groups on O'Connor. So I've read led several reading groups. So there's always occasions to go back and think more about O'Connor. And what I want to talk about tonight is some general things about O'Connor's writing, but how her faith and her writing go together and what that means for us. And this is something I always enjoy talking to students about. So if you know anything about O'Connor, you know that she's from Georgia. She was born in Savannah, Georgia, and lived most of her life in a place called Milledgeville, which was the capital of Georgia during the Civil War, but a pretty small town afterwards. She lived a quiet life. She lived on a dairy farm with her mom, a place called Andalusia. She had people who would come visit her, but for the most part, she spent her day going to Mass. She'd go to Mass in the morning and then go back to the house. She had lupus, and the medicine that she took to keep the lupus at bay wore her out very easily. So she would just spend a few hours of really intense writing, and then the rest of her day she would read, write letters to friends. But she had a very strong faith. And that really guided her writing, guided everything that she did. She thought a lot about art. In addition to writing her stories, she wrote essays. She wrote a lot of letters to friends. And in some of those essays and those letters, she reflected on what makes for good art. And what she thought art could do, the way she understood it, is that good art should lead us to better understand reality. So reading O'Connor is really like a punch in the face. And a punch in the face, if that's not real, I don't know what is. It's a way of bringing you back to reality. So I thought I'd start with a few quotes here that are kind of punches in the face, just to set the tone here. And some of these will be familiar to you, those of you who've read some O'Connor before. So most famously from her story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, you could probably say it if you've read that, the misfit, after he kills the grandmother, says, "She would have been a good woman if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life. How about that for a thought? Keep death before you always. Or from her story, Revelation, one of my favorites, a young woman named Mary Grace, named significant, throws a book in a waiting room at Ruby Turpin, and then jumps across the table, grabs her by the throat, and says, "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog." Another great quote. Not one you want to just walk around saying. And so her stories have all these great moments in them, these kind of hit you in the face moments. Her prose is like this too, if you read her essays. And I brought these books to show you, because you should add these to your library. And I like this version. You could tell I've read this book a lot because I had to get it rebound. This is all of her short stories. Her prose is collected in this book called Mystery and Manners that I recommend to you as well. Here's a couple of quotes from Mystery and Manners. She says that to the hard of hearing you shout, and for the almost blind you draw large and startling figures, way of explaining what she's doing in her fiction. Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it's because we're still able to recognize one. Defending the South there a bit. She adds in the same essay, "I think it's safe to say that while the South is hardly Christ-centered, it's most certainly Christ-haunted." Christ still haunts the South. In other words, people still have a moral conscience. They still recognize good and evil. To a friend, this is not her essays, this is her correspondence, and the most famous book of her correspondence is A Habit of Being. The best way to get to know O'Connor is just to read through her correspondence. She says to one of her friends, who's embarking on a trip to Rome, not with me in the summer, this was before I was going to Rome, but she famously told her friend, "When in Rome, do as you done in Milledgeville." And if you go to Andalusia and see O'Connor's farm, they sell bumper stickers that say that, and someone bought me one, but I did not put it on my car. It's in my office. "When in Rome, do as you done in Milledgeville." In her more serious moments, she is likely to make wise observations about the modern world, often remarking on the nihilism that she says is the gas we breathe. Here's one of the more famous quotes that she said about modernity. She says, "The moral sense has been bred out of certain sections of the population, like the wings have been bred off certain chickens to produce more white meat. This," she goes on to say, "is a generation of wingless chickens," which is, I suppose, what Nietzsche means when he said, "God is dead." She was most worried about nihilism in the church. It doesn't just infect society, it infects the church too. The gas is there. To understand this, we'd have to follow her to one of the few cocktail parties that she attended. She was not a fan of cocktail parties. She once told a friend that whoever invited or invented the cocktail party should be drawn and quartered. But she went as a graduate student and sat and listened to a conversation that took a theological turn. When she heard someone refer to the Eucharist as a symbol, she interrupted the conversation and said, "If it's just a symbol, then to hell with it. It doesn't mean anything." For O'Connor, nothing is more anti-nihilistic than the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Her second novel, which is called The Violent Bear It Away, is a minor hymn to the Eucharist, as she says. O'Connor thought the church and Christ are one, like a husband and wife are one. Nihilism in the church seeks to separate the church and Christ to create something like what we see in her first novel, A Church of Christ Without Christ. O'Connor was not a nihilist, obviously, though apparently some made the mistake thinking that she was when they first read Wise Blood and some of her early stories. It wasn't apparent to them that she was writing as a Catholic. She joked that people said that she was a hillbilly nihilist when in reality she's a hillbilly Thomist. Which is why this is a good TI talk, right? Thomistic society. As a Thomist, she believed she had more freedom than she would have had if she were a nihilist. As she put it in a 1956 letter, "I write with the solid belief in all of the Christian dogmas, I find that this in no way limits my freedom as a writer, and that it increases rather than decreases my vision. Here we return to the theme of vision. Vision is all over the place in O'Connor's works, and it's crucially important to understand what she's up to in her stories. As you read her stories, as I assume you'll read more of her stories or reread them throughout your life, notice the attention that she pays to people's eyes in those stories. There's a couple of examples. If you've read Parker's Back, who's read Parker's Back? A few people, okay. It's a great story about a man who gets tattoos all over his body, except for his back, because he can't see them. But to impress his wife, who's a Bible-only Christian, he gets a tattoo of a Byzantine Christ on his back. We're in the story, we're given a description of Parker's eyes, which the narrator tells us were pale, reflecting the vastness of the ocean. This contrasts with the tattooed Byzantine Christ that he gets on his back, which we're told has all demanding eyes. Under these eyes, Parker felt he was as transparent as the wing of a fly. After the artist, art's a big theme in that story, the tattoo artist finishes the tattoo, he wants Parker to look, to see the tattoo that he's put on his back. Parker's hesitant to do so, and when he does, he turns white at the sight of those eyes that seem to understand him better than he understands himself. This particular line from Parker's Back reminds me of something O'Connor says in an introduction to A Memoir of Mary Ann, kind of an unusual thing that she wrote, an introduction to a book. Anyone read that? Introduction to A Memoir of Mary Ann. That's where I got the title for my book. I'll say more about it in a bit. Mary Ann was a young girl, a 12-year-old girl who died. She had a tumor on her face, and she lived in a Dominican home for terminally ill cancer patients. A order, or a wing of the Democrat, or the Dominican order that was founded by Nathaniel Hawthorne's daughter, Rose Hawthorne. And so there was a literary connection there. The sisters wanted O'Connor to write Mary Ann's story because she was a saintly girl. O'Connor said, I don't really write stories like that, but if you write it, I'll write an introduction. So in that introduction, she is talking about Mary Ann's face. She's a beautiful girl inside, but she had this deformity on her face. And she's talking about herself and why it's easier for her and others to tell stories about things that aren't beautiful, aren't really beautiful. Because when we look in the face of evil, she says, we're likely to find our own reflection grinning back at us. It takes more courage to look in the face of the good. Parker, in the story, certainly struggled to look into the face of Christ. And yet, once those all-demanding eyes become part of him, and they're quite literally part of him because they're on his back, he starts to understand that the good in him is under construction and that he is full of promise, that he is loved, and that in some mysterious way, he's united to Christ. Consider, too, the way that eyes and vision are part of one of O'Connor's famous short stories, Everything That Rises Must Converge. Is this one familiar to you? A few people. Okay, good. Yeah. In this story, Julian and his mother are able to communicate to each other through their eyes. When Julian changes seats on the bus, he stares at his mother, making his eyes the eyes of a stranger. In the process of making his eyes tell a lie, he's unable to see the truth. The audience reading the story sees before the characters, before Julian, that the African-American woman with the child is wearing the same hat as Julian's mother. One of the things I love about that story is that we recognize it before they do. Julian was looking into the face he had never, after they exit the bus and after his mother is assaulted by the woman, Julian's mother's eyes now do not recognize him. What he did as a ploy to teach her a lesson on the bus, he gets for real in return. Julian was looking into the face, a face he had never seen before. In return, her eyes become unmoored. They rake his face, they find nothing, and then close. The last thing communicated to Julian by his mother's eyes is that he is nothing, presumably because he has forgotten who he is. But this is not the end. He will recover, as the closing line hints, by telling us that he is entering a world of guilt and sorrow through which we hope he will be under construction and full of promise, that he'll come to see that he is loved, that he may come to see. O'Connor tells us about people's eyes, but she's far more interested in what the eyes are seeing than what they look like. And I don't just mean what they are seeing physically. In fact, many of O'Connor's stories depict characters whose moral vision or moral sense, to tie this to the chicken quote, improves as their physical vision declines. So in the novel Wiseblood, the main character, whose name is Hazel Motes, his very name is a reference to eyes, is finally able to see moral truth once he is physically blinded, and he blinds himself like Oedipus. Or think of Joy Holga from one of my favorite stories, Good Country People. Hopefully you've read that one. If not, be sure you're sitting down when you read it. After Holga loses her glasses at the end of the story, along with her leg, she finally sees the bankruptcy of her education. She's been breathing the gas of nihilism with her studies. Manly Poynter, the conniving Bible salesman, laughs at her because he didn't have to go to college to learn how to believe in nothing. He's been doing it his whole life. Without her glasses, Holga's physical sight is blurry. But as Manly Poynter runs away, she sees something that looks like Christ walking on water, an indication that her moral sight is improving as her physical sight declines. Sometimes O'Connor's characters have mystical visions without necessarily losing their physical vision. So Ruby Turpin, the woman who is told to go back to hell, you warthog in Revelation, is the most obvious example of this. Her self-importance is shattered, and she seeks to know why God would allow something bad to happen to her. She's given the grace to see a brief vision that connects the temporal world to eternity. She's given the moral vision to see that the various types of people she thought she was better than are marching into heaven ahead of her. Physical looks can be deceiving. With better moral vision, Ruby Turpin will not be as easily deceived as she goes forward. She's under construction. She's learning that she's loved and full of promise. But it's not just the vision of O'Connor's characters that should be of interest to us. O'Connor's own vision matters, her vision as an artist. O'Connor believed that her job as a storyteller was to render her own vision of how things are, of reality, and make it accessible to us, her readers. A storyteller must have good moral vision, but where does that moral vision come from, especially at a time and a place where the thick gas of nihilism produces much moral darkness? Physically, when you block out a source of light, say the sun or a fire or a light bulb or a lamp, it does seem as though there is nothing to see because your eyes lack the light necessary to see the things that surround you. But the lack of light does not mean that the things around you are not there. It's just that you are unable to see them until whatever is obstructing the light is removed. Darkness is not really something in itself, but the absence of something. It's the absence of light. An analogous case can be made with moral vision. In order to discern good from evil, you need some medium that allows you to see things as they are. When that medium is obstructed, your moral vision struggles to recognize important parts of reality. Again, it doesn't mean that reality has changed, just that we cannot make it out because we're in the dark. If the obstructions are thick and present for a long time, our memory of moral reality, if we ever knew it, will fade, and we may be tempted to think good and evil do not really exist. We may be tempted to think they are simply made up to give us some means of orienting ourselves in the darkness. Pushing this a little further, sin is what darkens our moral sense. But grace, by grace, sin is removed so that our moral sense may be recovered. Few of us live in absolute darkness, and hopefully most of us want to live in the light, but the light is bright, and our moral vision needs time to adjust to it. One reason the gas of nihilism is so tempting is because it it softens the all-demanding light that most of us are not yet prepared to meet. Like Parker, we turn white when we encounter it head on. Most of us feel more comfortable living in some hazy area. The great danger is that we grow too comfortable with the haze, too comfortable with the gas, and that we just allow it to obscure our moral vision. But God is a nudging God, and sometimes he's willing to do more than nudge us or displace us so that we don't grow too content with the darkness. In O'Connor's stories, those nudges come to characters often through violent means. Setting a tree ablaze with a tractor, getting whacked by an iconoclastic broom, helplessly watching one's mother die of a stroke, having a book thrown at you, being told you're a warthog from hell. These are dramatic nudges, and perhaps our own lives will have some of these types of reminders of the eternal light as well. But it would be better, in a way, maybe, to call to mind that light by reading such violent moments rather than having to experience them ourselves. To some extent, we probably do have to experience them. But stories give us the chance to at least be prepared for those moments. God has given us many gifts. One of the gifts he's given us is the capacity to tell stories. Some have this gift in abundance and a corresponding vocation to be a storyteller. It's not a vocation for the faint of heart. It requires the careful study of how things are, both physically and morally. Storytellers like O'Connor often do things to help them with their physical vision. O'Connor, for example, was a painter, not because she wanted to be a great painter, but because being a painter forced her to pay attention to the details of physical reality. It takes no less patience or diligence to learn to see moral reality. In fact, it probably takes more work and perseverance. Whereas painting helped O'Connor learn to look at physical reality, reading was one of the means she used to improve her moral sight. I think prayer and her faith were part of that too, but she read broadly and deeply. Her purpose in reading was not to become a philosopher, something she never claimed to be, but to improve her moral vision so that she might become a better storyteller. She understood her vocation as being a storyteller. So what did she read? She read a lot. All academic subjects are related in some way and eventually converge. Right? Everything that rises must converge. This partially explains the eclectic nature of her reading. As such, she may never have to set out to become a student. She may never have set out to become a student of the history of political ideas. But in the course of her hunger to understand her faith and the reasons for its rejection by the modern world, she became acquainted with the classical, medieval, and modern schools of Western thought, including political thought, which she came to see was an essential part of developing a moral vision, especially if one is to successfully render that vision to members of an audience inclined by the tendencies of their modern democratic regime to welcome into their souls the gas of nihilism. It is therefore worth spending a couple minutes talking about, or at least looking at, some of the things that O'Connor read. I had, as part of my research on O'Connor, the opportunity to go to Milledgeville, where her personal library is kept at the college there. Milledgeville, where she attended, and I was able to just go through through her books and look at her marginalia. It's a lot of fun. as far as classic and medieval authors, she owned Plato's Apology, Crito, Phaedo's Symposium, and the Republic, Aristotle's Politics, Augustine's Confessions, Aquinas's Summa Theologiae, which she writes in a letter that she reads every night. She also read his treatise on law, which is part of the Summa. She owned Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling and Sickness Unto Death, both volumes of Tocqueville's Democracy in America, as well as his The Old Regime and the French Revolution, Henry Adams's The Education of Henry Adams, Heidegger's Existence and Being, and Joseph Pieper's Leisure as the Basis of Culture. Some of her books were about important political thinkers, such as Frederick Copleston's Aquinas and St. Thomas and Nietzsche. Other examples of such works are Romano Guardini's The Death of Socrates, which offers an interpretation of four Platonic dialogues, and Jean Guiton's The Modernity of St. Augustine. She owned books that provide a general overview of the history of ideas, such as the first three volumes of political theorist Eric Voegelin's Order and History, which is not easy reading, the last of which focuses on the political teachings of Plato and Aristotle. Jacques Maritain's The Range of Reason, Martin Darcy's Communism and Christianity, Guardini's The Faith of Modern Man, Christopher Dawson's Progress and Religion, Gustav Weigel's The Modern God, Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences, Marshall McLuhan's The Mechanical Bride, and John Henry Newman's Apologia Pro Vita Sua are other examples of books that she read and had in her personal library. In addition to O'Connor's library and personal letters, we also get an impression of O'Connor's understanding of the history of ideas from the 120 book reviews that she wrote for her local diocesan newspaper, and those are collected in this book. Have you ever looked at a diocesan newspaper, by the way? Can you imagine Flannery O'Connor writing book reviews in your diocesan newspaper? Some of them are really interesting. This is a review of part of her review of Russell Kirk's Beyond the Dreams of Avarice. She begins actually by talking about Romano Guardini. She says, Monsignor Guardini has written that when a man accepts divine truth in the obedience of faith, he's forced to rethink human truth. And it is such a rethinking in the obedience of divine truth which must be the mainspring of any enlightened social thought, whether it tends to be liberal or conservative. Since the Enlightenment, liberalism in its extreme forms has not accepted divine truth, and the conservatism, which has enjoyed any popularity, has shown no tendency to rethink human truth or to re-examine human society. Mr. Kirk has managed in a succession of books which have proved both scholarly and popular to do both and to make the voice of an intelligent and vigorous conservative thought respected in this country. O'Connor's not summarizing Kirk in this paragraph, but speaking on her own behalf. What's noteworthy here is not that she is embracing the intelligent and vigorous conservative thought of Kirk, which she only does tentatively as a better alternative to the more extreme forms of liberalism and reactionary conservatism, but that she returns, here with the aid of Guardini, to the medieval idea that political life must be approached in light of divine truth. Tactfully, she leaves room for both liberal and conservative thought to be enlightened through an obedient faith, and welcomes Kirk's efforts to do so for conservatism. O'Connor met Russell Kirk one time, and the story's pretty funny. She was excited to see him because she had read his books. He didn't know who she was. She had crutches because of her lupus. He asked her if she broke her leg. He really made all these mistakes. But after dinner, she read aloud to the party one of her stories. I forget which one. A Good Man is Hard to Find, probably. And Russell Kirk, who in addition to his political treatises, also wrote ghost stories, he was blown away by her stories, and he became a lifelong fan of O'Connor's. O'Connor wrote a friend that Kirk reminded her a little bit of Humpty Dumpty, and that letter was published in this book, which Kirk dutifully read after he died. So he has a funny reaction to that. If O'Connor's review of Kirk is not enough to convince us that she was familiar with the history of political ideas, I should point out that she also reviewed those first three volumes of Eric Voegelin's Order and History. I don't know, has anyone ever read Eric Voegelin? It's tough stuff. That's tough stuff. When I look through her copies of these volumes, someone told me she didn't have any marginalia in there. She probably didn't read them. I said, well, she wrote book reviews of them. She had to have read them. She kept her notes on these books on the dust, inside the dust jacket. So that was fun to prove somebody wrong. She did keep notes on this. These are tough books to read. But it's good to, if you ever have the chance to go and read what she has to say about Eric Voegelin's understanding of the history of ideas. I want to switch gears here just a little bit. Talk about going back to this idea of the moral vision of the storyteller. Given that we know O'Connor read all of these books, in addition to lots of other things that she read about theology and literature, what can we we say about her, moral vision and its relationship to storytelling? To get at this question, let me turn to what I think is her greatest summation of everything she was reading. It comes at the end of that introduction she wrote about Mary Ann, the life of Mary Ann. Here's what she says. This is, like I said, where I got the title for my book. One of the tendencies of our age is to use the suffering of children to discredit the goodness of God. And once you have discredited his goodness, you're done with him. In this popular pity, we mark our gain in sensibility and our loss in vision. If other ages felt less, they saw more, even though they saw with the blind, prophetical, unsentimental eye of acceptance, which is to say of faith. In the absence of this faith, we govern by tenderness. It is a tenderness which, long since cut off from the person of Christ, is wrapped in theory. When tenderness is detached from the source of tenderness, its logical outcome is terror. It ends in forced labor camps and in the fumes of the gas chamber. You can see how, when I read this, I saw it as almost a direct response to Rawls. There's a tenderness to Rawls, but it's severed from the source of tenderness. Abstract tenderness, tenderness in name, in the name of a class of people or a race of people or an ideal of some kind or of justice or of equality or freedom. Tenderness cut off from the real presence of Christ, the concrete body and blood of the Son of God, proceeds to nothing because it is severed from that which is real, severed from the incarnation. How many of O'Connor's characters display this modern tendency to be tender and whose tenderness leads to terror? Think of Julian, who we are told makes it a point when he gets on buses to sit down beside a Negro in reparation, as it were, for his mother's sins. At the end of Everything That Rises, after Julian's mother has been assaulted, Julian wants to tell her, "Don't think that was just an uppity Negro woman. That was the whole colored race, which will no longer take your condescending pennies." This is abstracted tenderness. His mother is literally dying as he says these words, dying because he failed to care for her the way he should. He lost track of the concrete. He lost track of the real. Part of the point of this story is that a storyteller must be careful not to give the audience what the audience thinks that it wants. This story is the closest O'Connor comes to writing on a hot political topic, bus desegregation in the South. Other writers were contributing stories that were intended to prick the consciences of Americans and thereby mobilize support for social justice. O'Connor was critical of writers like Eudora Welty, whose stories aimed at a political end, thus demoting storytelling from its highest and most noble purpose, showing the audience, which is already wrapped up in temporal concerns, a glimpse of the transcendent. O'Connor believes all good storytelling is concerned with using moral vision to help readers better see reality, to clear out some of the nihilistic gas, as it were. This, she would argue, is even the task of the non-Christian, non-believing storyteller. There is an integrity to telling stories, and all good storytellers must maintain that integrity by telling the truth as far as they can see it. In this way, they are like prophets, and prophets are always set against the political. Prophets are dangerous because they may report seeing something that is out of step with the goals of the regime. They may say things that run afoul of what is considered politically correct. Political regimes take a certain risk in allowing storytellers to render their vision. I keep using this phrase, rendering vision, so let me try and clarify what O'Connor means by that, because I'm borrowing it from her. Rendering vision is not creating reality, but discovering reality as best one can and sharing what one has discovered through dramatic art, which magnifies reality so that readers can come to see in a matter of minutes or hours what took the storyteller months or years or even decades to see. In the same way that painting immediately gives you a glimpse of what an artist is seeing, though it took them a long time to render that vision in the form of a painting. The vocation of the storyteller is to courageously speak what is true. It requires training one's physical and moral vision to see truth as clearly as possible. It is not about advancing abstract causes. It's not about advancing one's own reputation. It's not about becoming wealthy. It's about truth, goodness, and beauty. This should help explain O'Connor's claim that her faith is not a limitation upon her vocation as a storyteller or as a writer, but it gives her the freedom to say more in her stories than non-believers because her faith broadens and deepens her vision. She sees more, not less, because of her faith. A materialist, by contrast, is more limited because he must deny that he sees spiritual reality. Such a person must put a lens to his eye that restricts his vision in the same way binoculars restrict most of your vision for the sake of focusing on the one thing you do want to see. All literary lenses help a person see one thing more clearly at the expense of all other things. We should not think of O'Connor, the Catholic storyteller, as putting on a Catholic lens or a Thomistic lens or any kind of lens. For O'Connor, if the Catholic Church really is the one true apostolic church established not by humans but by God, then the Catholic storyteller is endeavoring to remove all lenses from his or her moral vision to see with the church. This does not mean seeing with the church's lenses or glasses or binoculars, but with her, that is, the church's very eyes. To avoid confusion, O'Connor usually tried to not call herself a Catholic storyteller or a Catholic writer, because everybody gets the wrong idea when they see the word Catholic modifying words like storyteller or writer. The tendency is to think of the pious writing about saints or about virtues, to think about the stories that edify and inspire. Good fiction isn't good because it makes us feel good about ourselves or our church or our country. Good fiction is good because, as I've been saying, and as O'Connor says, it helps us see the transcendent with greater clarity. It helps us grow in self-knowledge, which usually doesn't feel good. Growing in self-knowledge is often painful because we are all under construction. To be a Catholic storyteller is first and foremost just to be a storyteller, to have all the attributes and abilities of those with the gift of writing fiction. The Catholic part is not a qualification, but an indication of a broader vision. And that broader vision is possible because the church will lend its own eyes to those who want to see. I don't mean the church will give someone lenses or binoculars. She will actually give her eyes, as they did to O'Connor. Again, this does not mean the Catholic storyteller tells stories that only Catholics want to hear. This is part of why O'Connor has such a broad appeal. Ethan Hawke just made a movie about Flannery O'Connor. The Catholic storyteller sometimes tells stories Catholics do not want to hear. I know many a pious Catholic who refuses to read O'Connor because they find the stories scandalous. The Catholic storyteller then has a double burden. As a storyteller, someone like O'Connor has to be true to the ends of storytelling in general, which is like being a prophet who has to report truths that people do not want to think about. But a Catholic storyteller like O'Connor also has the burden of seeing more, therefore having to render more, much of which will be discomforting even to fellow believers. Time to bring this on home, right? Let's do it. I'm going to conclude by reflecting upon the challenges of being a Catholic storyteller in a nation like America and a democratic regime like ours. There's no better guide for understanding modern democracy, I think, than Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm sure you've all read some Democracy in America. I hope so. If not, I'm going to send you a copy and you could read it. O'Connor read Democracy in America. It's one of the books that she owned. Tocqueville shows us the extent to which our country loves abstract concepts like equality. He also shows us that our philosophic tendencies are mostly Cartesian. America is the place where Descartes' arguments are most followed and least read, as Tocqueville says. This leads many Americans to take their bearings on just about all matters from their own mind. They all say, as Americans, we tend to say, I think, therefore I am. For all its faults, aristocracy turns people's attention to the concrete and to the particular. citizens of aristocracies ignore at their peril those on whom they depend and those who are dependent upon them. But in democracies, the links of responsibility are no longer imposed by any authority outside of the self. Acting rightly towards one's neighbors remains a moral duty, but it is no longer a political duty, or at least it is harder to understand why it might be a political duty. The more obvious political duty in the eyes of Cartesian democratic citizens is standing up for abstract causes of various kinds. Tenderness for the particular people one lives with is only a moral concern. Tenderness for justice, freedom, equality, the economy, or whatever, these forms of tenderness are understood and accepted by democratic citizens. Much of the political debate in this country revolves around arguments over which abstract principle is most deserving of our sympathy. O'Connor read at least parts of Tocqueville's Democracy in America. From it and other books, she came to understand that the Catholic storyteller in democratic times has to lead democratic readers to be concerned with the particular, with the concrete, with the flesh and blood of reality, and not just with abstract principles. At the same time, the Catholic storyteller cannot ignore the transcendent. And this is the key. The transcendent is different from the abstract. It's more real. It is real. It is reality. Social justice and individual liberty are concepts, important concepts, but they're concepts, they're ideas. Truth, goodness, and beauty are not mere concepts. They do not exist in our minds. Rather, our minds come to see them, experience them, and hopefully embrace them. But the only way to come to see them, paradoxically, is through our senses, encountering the concrete elements that point to the transcendent. It is through nature that we experience grace, and it is through the manners of a temporal community that we are directed to the mystery of the eternal community. That's the name, mystery and manners. There's a connection between mystery and manners. God is not a conception either. He's not an idea. He doesn't just live in our minds. The whole point of Scripture is that God is a person who cares about us, and the best way of encountering him is in the flesh. The good news of the gospel is that such a thing is possible. And if this ends up not being true, if God did not become man and dwell among us and die for our sins and rise on Easter and offer himself anew each day upon the altar, then we would have no choice but to join O'Connor in saying, well, then, to hell with all that. O'Connor tells a beautiful story in one of her letters about passing by the dragon. That part of what we all have to do is advance down this road where we're going to encounter some kind of a dragon. And for her, the beauty of the sacraments and the beauty of coming to know reality is that it better prepares us to face that dragon and to make it by the dragon. That's what's usually happening in O'Connor's stories. Her characters are encountering the dragon. Satan's usually there somewhere in the story. And what O'Connor almost always does with the character that's the Satan character, the dragon, is that in trying to tear that person down, bring them down, bring them to hell, they end up being the occasion for some moment of grace. The devil ends up losing all of these stories simply by trying to do his job too well. He ends up being the reason people are smacked in the face with reality. And when you're smacked in the face in reality, you turn to the thing that's most real, which for O'Connor and for the Thomistic Institute is Christ. So thanks for your time.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.